Okay, I have to thank everyone for coming. So in preparation for Pesach, let me mention a few things. Last week at this time, we discussed the kitchen and how to prepare the kitchen for Pesach. That was last week. Yeah, this is the second part of a series. So I don't know if you're on the email list. But if not, I don't know. You know what to say. So again, we spoke at great length about kashering ovens and microwaves and countertops and different types of sinks and what the sinks are made of and stainless steel and porcelain.
Do you have a summary of it?
It's online, so if you just give me your email, I'll send you a link and then you can listen to the shear online.
Okay. Do you have all your shears?
I try. That's what I have this little machine
for.
ELC
online?
Yes, this is for the ELC. Now, tonight I want to pick up on something. How are you ladies? How are you doing? Okay, welcome. I want to pick up on something that we touched on at the end of the last class, but we weren't able to really get into more detail. And as you know, but stop me if you don't know, the Ashkenazic Jews don't eat kidneys on Pesach. And kidneys are various kinds of legumes that are used to make a kind of a flour substance. A classical case would be corn. We can make corn flour. And Rav Moshe Feinstein, in one of his tshuvas, was wondering about potatoes. Why is it that potatoes are allowed for Ashkenazim? It should be a classical case of kidneys. It has a lot of the elements of kidneys, and also you can take potatoes, as we do, and convert them into flour. So he comes up with a brand new idea. And I don't know how many people in this room enjoy quinoa, just by a show of hands. Okay, quinoa. Okay, to me, quinoa is like a staple. You know, I can't live without it. You know what I'm saying? And it's supposed to be very healthy, too. So I want to mention Rav Moshe's breakthrough as far as potatoes. And he says like the following. The tradition, the custom of kidneys for Ashkenazim dates back to the Maharil. The Maharil lived in the 1400s.
Before the potato was discovered.
Exactly. We didn't have potatoes in those days, believe it or not. Potatoes came in the 1500s, probably almost a full century later. So Moshe Feinstein says the following. Anything that we knew about at the time of the Minna, when the Minna came into existence, is included under kidneys. Anything like the potatoes, which we discovered after the minhag was established, after that custom was taken upon itself, that's not considered kidneys. Interesting. Now, the issue of quinoa was an issue that was addressed by the OU approximately, I would say, about, I'm just guessing, 2003, something like that, would be about 15 years ago, just rounding it off. And the OU came out with a heter. They said, you're allowed to use quinoa for Pesach. And, hi, how are you? Come, join us. And the reason for that is because we didn't get quinoa until very recently. You know, maybe they had it in South America, but they didn't reach, you know, the Ashkenazi communities until very recently. And therefore wasn't included in the original custom. And that was the heter based on Rav Moshe Feinstein.
There's no chametz in
kidneys. No, kidneys is only made of legumes.
Exactly, so there's no chametz.
No chametz, but the Ashkenazim took it upon themselves as a special custom, a very powerful custom, again, back in the 1400s, we're almost six centuries back, not to eat kidneys on Pesach.
Quinoa isn't kidneys either.
Oh, so there were two arguments here against those who wanted to get concerned about quinoa. One argument is it's not a legume, it's a seed. And the other argument is that it wasn't around at the time of Maharil, and therefore was never included in the original custom of kidneys. So the OU came out with a very strong position here, that you're allowed to eat, an Ashkenazic Jew is allowed to eat quinoa on Pesach. And based on that tshuva of the OU and that position of the OU, my wife and I use kinua heavily on Pesach. Our cholent is made up of mostly meat and kinua. That's, you know, we throw in a few other vegetables too, just to make it a little colorful, because kinua is not so colorful. It's a little bit dry. However, here's where history takes its part. It's very interesting. The OU is governed, so to speak, in the Kashrus division by two great rabbis, one of which passed away just recently, in the last 2 years, Rabbi Belsky. And the other is Tzolzayin Gesund Shtark, is Rabbi Herschel Schechter. I was learning in his kol for many years at Yeshiva University. Rav Belsky reversed his position. He found out that when they package kinua, they use the same packaging plants as they do for other grains, and therefore it has a very strong element of an isur. And not only that, he claims that, I'll just read this to you because I want to make sure I say it the right way. Okay. Oh. He says the following, that there's something called maize, M-A-I-Z-E. I think that's a Spanish word, I'm not sure. But anyway, it's made
corn.
Of corn.
It's corn in Spanish.
What is it called in Spanish?
Maíz.
Maíz.
Maíz is corn.
Okay.
Oh, maize is maíz.
Correct. And guess what? This particular product was not around at the time of the Maril in the 1400s. And yet the Mishnah Berurah writes that it's considered kidneyos. It arrived in Ashkenazic communities in Europe way after the 1400s. So Rabbi Belsky now began to get very nervous about kinua for two reasons. First of all, because of the plant, of the way that they package it and the factories and so forth, and he was afraid the grains might get mixed in. And secondly, because of this Mishnah Berurah, as far as maize is concerned, corn maize. So he retracted the original position of the OU. Rav Schechter never retracted his position, and basically the OU leaves it that it's usur, but we don't use it, but you consult with your own Orthodox rabbi. You know, they didn't want to come to any definite conclusion. Now there's another major organization for kashrus in America that's located in Baltimore, Maryland. That's called, anybody know? The Star K. The Star K is organized by Rabbi Heinemann. In my humble opinion, and others will agree with me, it is the most reliable hechsher in the United States. And he was very upset when the OU retracted its original heter, and he says, we're not going to change our position. As far as the fact that it's packaged together with other grains, he says, we have strict supervision. And the Star K on a bag of quinoa indicates that no problem. There's no mixture of any grains. And as far as kidneys is concerned, it's not included in the original Xer of kidneys for those two reasons. It's not a legume. And it was introduced way later after Rav Moshe Feinstein. So that's the story of quinoa. Here in Israel, You may know this, you may not know this. A lot of things that we're used to from Chutz Laretz, and we eat them and we cook with them on Pesach, the Israelis never accepted that heter, that permission, and they're very strict about it. So, for example, when I was growing up, we used cottonseed oil, we used peanut oil. And all this has come under attack here in Israel. So, for example, if you want to buy cottonseed oil for Pesach, it'll say on it, La'ochle kidneos bilvad, which means it's only for Sfaradim. But if you come from the background that I come from Chutz Laretz, don't pay any attention to that. Just use it for Pesach. Okay, then? And I never accepted any of these chumras, any of these minhagim here in Eretz Yisrael. This is the way I was brought up, and I continue my minhag from my house. There's no reason that I have to accept those minhag. That's as far as kinu was concerned. Now, another issue in kidneys, which came up today, and someone sat right here on this table and he asked me this question. He didn't sit on the table, I meant to say by the table. And he asked me, he has two children that are still being bottle fed and he wants to know if he could feed them kidneys. The certain types of Materna that's made from kidneys, it has a hechsher for Pesach, for it's for only for Oakley kidneys. And I told him that I would research it, and I researched it, and I found that the poskim are lenient for older people and for young children, and they never expanded that minhag to include those. So there was never a minhag to prohibit. And I told him that he should buy Pesach thicker bottles, you know, to use that specifically, but it's not really Pesach thick. It's neither Pesach thick nor it's Chametz thick. It is kidney stick. And why do I say it's kidney stick? Because those utensils should be used exclusively for children. You know, sometimes, you know, it may come up that you want to use a bottle for something. Don't use those bottles. You know, designate that just for the children, and that's okay. What else can I tell you about kidneys? Oh, this is very interesting. I found something fascinating about kidneys. A lot of what has kidneys in it is only one ingredient. And there are many, many other ingredients in the product. Now, if something is prohibited on Pesach and it falls into a mixture on Pesach, then we're very, very careful about that. That's called chametz osur b'mashu. Even a small crumb could prohibit a large amount of food. But if it got mixed up before Pesach, then we apply the principle of bittul, which means that if it's less than the majority, it's bittul b'rov, if it's everything is dry. And I saw that one of the poskim today says the following, the same thing should apply to kidneys. And therefore, we consider canola oil, for example, as kidneys. And that's even true in America. That's because it's made from something called rapeseeds. And if it was used as one ingredient in a product, then it's bottle and you can use it on Pesach. There are those who are very strict about that. But I was very excited to see that the logic was that if on with regard to real chametz, we apply the principle of bittul when it's a smaller element that's lost in a larger amount, then certainly we should apply that to kidneys, which is not chametz. The logic is that we should be more careful about chametz than we should be about kidneys. So if there's a law of bittul in mixtures and tarobas and with regard to chametz mamish, then how much more so with regard to kidneys? Okay, those are the few things that I didn't get a chance to mention last time. Now, what I have here, if anyone is interested, is a list, which I didn't have last week when I gave the shiur, a list of cosmetics for Passover. Okay? Now, this list is not updated, but it's pretty much updated. And he tells you, basically, because a lot of cosmetics have alcohol in them. And the question is whether alcohol would be bottled before Pesach. And the answer to this is, number one, there are two types of alcohol. There's synthetic alcohol, and there is alcohol that's made from grains. Like, for example, ethyl alcohol might be made from grains. Not necessarily. But there are other types of alcohol. So this is a very fine list. And I don't know if there's anyone here who might enjoy certain perfumes from Lauder, Estee Lauder.
I thought all perfumes are not, I mean, it's not something you eat.
Well, again, there are two issues in perfumes. One is whether I have to sell it with the chametz, and the other is whether I can use it.
I thought nowadays they say you can use all perfumes.
Okay, so it's complicated. If the, listen carefully, if the alcoholic ingredient is made from grains, okay, not the ones on this very extensive list, then you don't have to sell it, but you might have to lock it up rather than use it as a perfume. Why? Because chametz, again, I'm not saying this is chametz, but if it's chametz, is osur b'hanah, which means that not only are you forbidden from eating chametz, you're not allowed to have any benefit from it. So if you use it as a cosmetic, that becomes a violation of the isur hanah. Now the question becomes, Well, first of all, are these alcohols made from grains? And secondly, even if they are, we have a principle called nifsal. Okay, I'm just going to write this down. Nifsal means that it's no longer edible. So you can have something that's derived from grains, but it's no longer edible. So when was the last time that you swallowed your perfume? Ah, never, right? Hopefully. Very dangerous to swallow perfume. But Rav Aaron Cutler, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who was the Rosh Yeshiva and the founder of Lakewood Yeshiva, and he's quoted extensively in a book called The Laws of Pesach from Rav Shimon Eider, which in my day was like, that was like the Bible of the laws of Pesach. He writes that Rav Aaron Cutler read in a newspaper, that was a chiddush to me that Rav Aaron read newspapers, and it said in the newspaper that there was a shipwreck, and there was a group of people who were on an island, they had nothing to eat, and they took perfumes and other kinds of cosmetics, and they were able, through a heating process, to remove the alcoholic, edible element within the perfumes. Now, I don't know exactly, they must have had a very happy time on the island, you know, if that's, you know what I'm saying? But this gave Rav Aaron Cutler the feeling that it's not nifsal. Why isn't it nifsal? If there's any way that I can extract an edible element from this mixture, then it's not nifsal, because potentially it's still edible. And the poskim rejected this. They said, no, we don't agree with the Rosh Yeshiva, with all due respect. They held that in the present state, it's not edible. It's nifsal. I don't have to ask the question, what can I do to change the state of this mixture and extract the chametz element? So Shimon Ida basically comes to the conclusion, after he discussed it with Rav Moshe Feinstein, that those who want to be more machmir and not use these perfumes on Pesach, is that's a good idea to follow Rav Aaron Cutler's psak. But our general minug is to if this perfume or cosmetic is not on the list of those that are completely chametz-free, synthetic alcohol, and so on, then if it's not on the list, put it away for Pesach. You don't have to sell it with your chametz, but don't benefit from it on Pesach. So that's another thing that I wanted to share with you that I didn't have. Okay. Yeah, please. Michael,
I just wanted to come back to Kitniot. We were looking today for toothpaste that had a sign that said "No Kitniot," and we couldn't find any. Do you have to be careful with toothpaste as well?
Toothpaste should be a little careful because it goes in the mouth.
Right.
And I don't. I'm not sure why you found that problem. I mean, I myself saw, not this year, I didn't go shopping, but last year I saw, you know, toothpaste that said Kosher LePesach on it.
Kosher LePesach, but not.
Right.
Not,
if it says Kosher LePesach, then unless they qualify it, you can assume it's not kidneys.
No, but surely everything you have to.
In other words, every hechsher in this country. Like, let's say, for example, Chassam Sofer, or Badatz, or Rabbanut, whatever hechsher it is, if it's got kidneys on it, they always add that as a proviso. They'll write, again, in Hebrew, they'll write, kosher for Passover, but not for Ashkenaz, meaning, la'ochle kidneys bilvad. And it's very tricky, my friends. When you go shopping, I don't care where you're going shopping, Osharad, whatever your favorite place is, I'm not here for advertisements, but you always have to look at the print. Because this country is made up of mostly Sfaradim. I think Sfaradim are 55% of the Jewish population in this country. And therefore, the fact that it has a hechsher doesn't necessarily mean that it's for you and I as Ashkenazim. But they are required by law to add the words Le'ochle Kidneys Bilvad. Now again, are there violations of the law? I don't know.
So it's not the negative, because they
right. As long as they say Kosher LePesach and it has a well-known certified Ashgacha,
Rabbanut, is that okay?
That's fine. Then you know it's for Ashkenaz. Okay. Okay then.
It's actually a Mechiras Chametz.
Mechiras Chametz.
Ideally, what, as far as I understand, is that if there's a Hefzid Merubah like whiskey, like bread.
That's a good question. So. I would probably be working against my own best interest here, but the truth is what has to go. Selling chametz is a bit complicated. It works, And you know, what we do is to effectuate and validate the transition, the transaction with a guy, we do everything under the sun. Every single possible kinyan. We do a kinyan shtar, and we do a kinyan chotzer, and we do a kinyan agav, and we do a kinyan odisa. There are many different types of kinyanim, and we use them all just to make sure. Like, for example, a woman asked me the following question. She is buying whiskey on her way out of the country in duty-free Ben Gurion Airport, and they have a service in which they store it for her. This is whiskey that's chametz gomer, the real McCoy chametz, and they store it for her as a service to her. They do not sell chametz. She picks up the whiskey when she returns from chutzlitz after the chag. Can I sell it for her? Now, normally, when I sell chametz,
can you buy the whiskey the duty free the day after?
No, that's not in her possession.
That hasn't been sold. Can you buy duty free the day after Pesach? That hasn't been sold.
That's another question.
It's a similar issue.
She was asking whether she could sell the chametz.
How is the boy going to get access to that?
So normally, what happens is the following: that you have chametz in your possession. Let's say it's locked up in a closet here, a closet there, wherever the heck it is. It doesn't matter to me. And then what we can effectuate is what's called a kinyan chotzer. How do we effectuate a kinyan chotzer? So the guy acquires a small piece of your property, and he acquires it through what's called schirus, which is literally rental. But rental is enough to effectuate chotzer, which means that anything in that area, he can be kona through chotzer. Here, she's got it in Ben Gurion Airport. She has no rights. Now, I said if she pays for rights to store it, then she might be a renter, and then she can transfer the rental powers or authority over to me and I to the guy. But here, she's getting it gratis as a service. So she really has nothing to stand on. So here's where we introduce another kinyan, which is called kinyan agav. And kinyan agav, again, it's not for us now, because this will take the whole balance of our class, and I did prepare a class for tonight. Maybe you don't believe me, but just kidding. Anyway, so the kinyan agav means that if she rents out a piece of property, of real estate, what's called karka, then she can transfer ownership over metaltalin, which chametz is metaltalin, it's movable, anywhere on the face of the earth. We don't require tsurim. There's one day that requires, we don't pass like that day. And through that piece of karka, which she is giving over to the guy as a rental, she can be machna, means she can transfer ownership over metaltalin, over movable objects, anywhere on the face of the earth, even on the moon. So there's a solution, hopefully, to every single problem. Is there a solution to buying chametz from a Jew after Pesach who didn't sell his chametz? I remember when I was brought up in America, there were certain supermarkets that we knew right after Yontif we could buy there because they were owned by goyim. And then there were other supermarkets, in my day it was called Walbaum's, that were owned by Jews. It's only when I was much, much older that they had a certificate that they sold their chametz, and we knew not to buy their chametz. And you had to really wait until the new stock of cereals came in order to buy chametz. Do you remember this?
No, I don't, but it's fascinating.
Yeah, this was in my youth. The A&P, I don't know if you heard of A&P. Yeah, very sure. Famous chain in America.
I think it's
owned by Goyim, you know what I'm saying? If you're not Italian, forget it. And we knew that we could buy chametz there right after Pesach. So in this case, if Ben Gurion Airport is selling you chametz, and they're not, but you know what? There's a difference between the owner of the duty free shop and the owner of the storage. The duty free shop might—I don't remember now—but I think they do sell the chametz, so they have a certificate. So buying whiskey on the way in is not a problem. The problem, Ben Gurion, is if you own the chametz and it was stored, because the storage people—it's known that they don't sell chametz. Okay, what I'd like to talk to you first about is the wine for the Seder. A few points about wine for the Seder. Point number one, the amount of wine, the volume of wine that should be used in the cup of wine, each of the cups of wine, is the minimum should be 3.3 ounces. Okay, that's for those of us who are used to ounces. Now, this year, the night of the Seder coincides with Shabbos. And therefore, the first of the four cups of wine is the cus of Kiddush. When it comes to Kiddush, we're more machmir. There are Rishonim, it's not for a discussion over the counter now, that hold that Kiddush al Yayin is Doraisa, it's a biblical law, and therefore we require for the first cup 4.4 ounces. We encourage using red wine. And the reason for that is that red wine, first of all, is intoxicating, so is white wine, but red wine has the additional advantage that it reminds us of Dam. Okay. The second best wine would be white wine. It's also intoxicating. And then we get down to grape juice. Grape juice is okay for those who can't drink wine. I would recommend adding a little bit of a mixture of wine with the grape juice if possible. But the thing you have to be careful about grape juice, and this is very relevant to elderly people, is not to add too much water. Because if you add too much water, it dilutes the grape juice. And the grape juice itself is a little bit diluted. So just to write down, if you will, the following. The ratio between grape juice and water should always be the following. It should be 2/5 grape juice and maximum 3/5 of water. If it becomes more than 3/5 of water, and this is Ashkenazim, the Sfaradim are much more machmir on this, then it's too diluted and it's not to be used. Okay. Now, I want to tell you something about the mitzvah of drinking 4 kosos. Number one, women are obligated like men in the drinking of the 4 kosos. And this becomes an issue, especially when we get to the last of the 4 kosos, because the women are exhausted. And I always tell my wife, the best thing she could do for preparing for Pesach is getting some rest on Erev Pesach. And that's the most difficult thing to do, because it's almost not in the books. But that's the greatest preparation you can have. Okay. Now, watch this. There's a direct relationship between the first cup of wine and the second cup of wine. The first cup of wine is Kiddush. And Kiddush is Zecher Liyetzias Mitzrayim. In fact, Rav Sadia Gaon, who lived about 1,200 years ago, he had a separate Kiddush, a new Nusach for Kiddush, for the night of Pesach. And the reason for that is that long Kiddush, which goes on for pages, tells the whole story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. So the first cuss is really part and parcel of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. Therefore, it connects to the second cuss. The second cuss is called the cuss of Magid. And the best thing that you could do is not to talk anything extraneous until you, from the time that you made Kiddush until the time that you drank the second kos of Yain. Lo yafsik, I'll read it to you. Be emtza miras ha-gado, besichas chulin. Again, if you have to ask for something that's relevant, obviously if you're discussing Yetzias Mitzrayim or something that's halachic, that's not a hefsek. That doesn't interrupt. But to start talking about who's going to be the next prime minister or something, you know, that's not relevant. The next thing I wanted to talk to you about is a bracha on the mitzvah of Dalid Kosos. The Ashkenazic minug is that we recite Bori Pri Hagafen on all 4 cups of wine. But that's not what I'm talking about. That's what's called a Birchas HaNenin, that you make anytime you eat something. I'm talking about a Birchas HaMitzvah, which goes like this, Asher Kidshonu Mitzvosu V'tzivonu Al. And there should have been a bracha Al Shtias Dalid Kosos, a mitzvah to drink 4 cups of wine. And if you'll say, well, it's only a rabbinic mitzvah, but on the night of Pesach we make a bracha on Maror. And Maror in our time is only rabbinic, because the Torah links up Maror with the Korban Pesach. So now that we don't have the Korban Pesach, we have Maror Derabbanan, and yet we make a bracha on Maror Derabbanan. What other mitzvahs Derabbanan do we make a bracha on? Chanukah, Purim, Megillas Esther, it's all Derabbanan. We make brachas. We don't shy away from a mitzvah Derabbanan. So we should be making a bracha on Dalid Kosos. So some say the following, that in at least in 2 out of the 4 cups, we would be obligated in that cup, in those 2 cups, that's number 1 and number 3, that's Kiddush and Birkas HaMazon, irrelevant to Pesach. even if we didn't have the mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, we would still require a bracha on Kiddush, and number three, a bracha on Birkas HaMazon. And therefore, the Nusach HaBracha would be inaccurate. Mimonashach would be inaccurate, because to say that we're mitzuvah in four cups of wine, that's not really true, because two out of the four were already obligated in irrelevant and independent of Pesach. And not only that, if you want to make a bracha on two out of the four, that's also inaccurate, because we're obligated to drink four cups of wine. So there's no bracha on the mitzvah Dalet Kosos, but my friends, I don't want you to think that that makes it into a lower grade mitzvah. In fact, Dalet Kosos is a very high grade mitzvah. The Mishnah says that we have to guarantee, when I say we, I mean the community, that every single family, every household is equipped, no matter how poor they are, with Dalet Kosos. And there's a famous story about a couple that came to see Rav Yosher Ber Soloveitchik. That's my Rebbe's great-grandfather. He was the Beis Halev. And they asked him, can we use milk on the night of the Seder? Because we can't afford wine. So at that point, the Beis Halevi goes into an inner chamber and he says to his Rebbetzin, I need 50 rubles. I don't remember exactly what the number was. So he comes out and he gives this couple 50 rubles. After they leave, his wife says to him, wait a minute, four cups of wine? That's about 20, 25, 30 rubles. Why 50 rubles? He says the following. If they're asking about milk, it means they don't have money for meat either. Because you don't drink milk and meat at the same meal. If we got to add it and jack it up for another 20 rubles so that they can get some meat for the same. And the Mishnah says that we go into the community chest to make sure that everyone has four cups of wine.
Rabbi, you had mentioned adding the water to grape juice. And I know it sounds awful, but what about adding water to the wine?
Also, you should keep it at a minimum, not too much, and make sure that there's a ratio. I would say at least half of it should be wine, even though technically the poskim say 2/5, but I would say leave it at half.
Okay.
What we do is some of us add grape juice to the wine.
That's the best thing. If you have it trouble drinking dry wine, or even sweet wine, you know, Moscato and all that stuff, then add grape juice and dilute it.
The Kiddush wine should have many wine, right?
Kiddush is more chamur, because the Rambam writes that Kiddush has to be the wine that can be used for Nisach HaGavim Mizbeach, which has no added sweeteners to it, and no wine, no honey, and so forth and so on. And grape juice is very questionable. As far as Dalet Kosos, grape juice is a bit questionable, because the Rashbam, one of the great Rishonim, was of the opinion that you could only be yotzei this mitzvah with intoxicating beverage. That's not politically correct today, but the reason why you need an intoxicating beverage is because part of the mitzvah is to express simcha, and simcha is connected to yayin, because the pasuk says v'yayin yisamach lev enosh, and the simcha, the joy of drinking wine, is the element of an intoxicating beverage. Again, some people love grape juice.
You don't enjoy drinking wine?
That's an excellent question. So again, I think we come back to what Benji said. Try to make a mixture. I'll tell you why. Obviously, you want to enjoy the wine, and therefore, if you don't enjoy dry wine, I don't know if you really fulfilled the mitzvah the way it was meant to be. But on the other hand, wine has that element. So I'm sort of caught between a rock and a hard place. The best thing is to try to make a compromise and balance between the two. All right, let me move on, because I have a lot to discuss with you tonight. First of all, we have a tradition that a firstborn on Erev Pesach should fast. That's called Tainis Bechoros. Many Sfaradim will include the women firstborn as well, because all this is to celebrate our salvation on the night of Pesach, when the Mashkis, that was the destroying agent of God, was killing the Bechoros, the firstborn. And Medrash says the firstborn included males, where they were firstborn to the father or to their mother, and females the same. So therefore even females should be fasting, because the fasting somehow is a prayer that God should spare us from this decree. Okay, now the Ashkenazim accept the Ramah. The Ramah says that the women don't have to fast on Erev Pesach, so it's really for the men. And the best way of avoiding this, and that's the custom, is to attend a siyum. And in almost every shul across the globe, somebody makes a siyum, finishes a masechta on Erev Pesach. However, I just want to point out, and the poskim are very upset, some people miss the siyum, there's some leftovers from the siyum, and they think that they can eat from that. The real matir, you know, that permits and permits eating and removes the mitzvah of tainis, is the siyum itself. That makes it into a day of simcha, even though you didn't make the siyum, you didn't complete a masechta, but you feel a certain identification with the person who did finish a masechta, and therefore you participate in that simcha. But to come in after the siyum is over, and I've seen this with my own eyes, that's not right. And therefore, we have all sorts of ways of avoiding the fasting. Many poskim say that even if you're not a Bukhar, but your child is a young child who's not capable of fasting, let's say he's a newborn baby, and he's, the poskim even talk about a case of his wife gave birth on the 14th of Nisan, so now he has a baby who's a Bukhar, who's his first child, and he should be fasting. We find all sorts of leniencies how we can allow such a case eating. And some say that even if you hear the siyum over the phone, you could participate in the eating. Normally, a su'udas mitzvah requires washing and benching. Here, in the case of a siyum, we're going to allow any sort of minimal participation, fruits. Who wants to bring, you know, bread or whatever on Erev Pesach into the shul for the siyum? Okay. Next, I want to talk to you a little bit about the mitzvah of Heseba. Heseba is leaning, as you know. And there is a fundamental debate about the mitzvah of leaning. Some say that it's part and parcel of the Dalit Kosos, which means that if you were to drink any one of the four Kosos without reclining, you would have to repeat the drinking. I have a lot to say about that. We'll just mention a few things. The other approach says that no, Heseba leaning is just a separate mitzvah unto itself. It doesn't define the mitzvah of Dalit Kosos. And therefore, even if you didn't lean, you didn't recline, you were yotzei the mitzvah. We rely on the Shita of the Rav Yoh. The Rav Yoh says that in our time, in our generation, and he lived 1,000 years ago, we're not used to reclining, and therefore it doesn't have the same significance as it had back in the day. And therefore, if you didn't recline, you were yotzei. How much more so, he says, in the case of women. The Gemara has a suffix back and forth. Do women have to recline, or do they not have to recline? Some poskim write, if a woman is married, in the presence of her husband, she does not have to recline. But if she's single or divorced, then she's alone, she doesn't, or her husband is on a trip and he's not there to say that, she does recline. Others say that all our women today have to recline, and that's going to be the minute. Now, usually what do we recline on? Let's see if everyone here would agree with me. What do you usually take for reclining?
Pillow.
A pillow, no? Is that strange to you?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I'm not so sure about a pillow. I'll tell you why. The Gemara says that back in the day when they reclined, it was reclining on something. Something that held you up. So for example, I don't know how common it is to find an armchair today. If you don't own an armchair, go out and buy one. I'm just kidding. But seriously, try to get a hold of an armchair, because then you can recline on the arm. In the time of the Gemara, they used to lie down and recline on the mattress. Or when there were students around, one student would recline on the knee of another student. So whatever it is, don't just lean back. You know, I've seen people who, you know, they drink like this. They're just suspended in midair. That's not reclining. Reclining means that you're reclining on something. Now, the reclining is required as an absolute minimum for the four cups of wine, for the matzah, and for karpas, according to many. And we can talk about karpas. Try not to forget about reclining. It's very, very important. Why is it so important? The Gemara says as follows. Chayav Adam Liros es Atzmo Ki'ilu Hu Yotzav Mitzrayim. The apex, the pinnacle of what we're doing on this side of the Seder is we are experiencing the exodus from Mitzrayim. The Rambam goes a step further. Rambam says, Chayav Adam Laharos es Atzmo. It's not enough that he, in his mind, he thinks that he's experiencing liberation and freedom. He's got to actually demonstrate it. And I don't know if you know, the Iraqi Jews have a very beautiful minhag. They put a big basin of water on the table, on the floor, and they line up one after the other. Each person puts a matzah on his right shoulder and crosses over the water to sort of give you the sense of what it was like at the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim. I'm not saying that I advocate that minhag, but at least reclining, that has to be an essential part of Chayav Adam Lirusis Atzmo. Now, as we recline, we recite a pasuk, and the pasuk says, "Zochas Hayom Hazeh Shayatzasa Mimitzrayim." In the singular means you have to experience the Yetzia Mimitzrayim as if you yourself went out of Mitzrayim. That's why, for the sake of the children, and the Seder is very much centered on the children, Vigadatol Bincha, we should try to demonstrate as much as we can for the children. We should throw around frogs. I don't mean live frogs. That's not a great idea. But you know, you can buy a kit now for children, and they have, you know, different kinds of skits that you can put on. All this really enhances the mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim.
What was the reason why women shouldn't need to lean?
Because the Gemara says that leaning is considered derech cherus.
Exactly. So
and it has an element.
The whole thing's like, they're part of the same.
So whenever someone, for example, Gemara talks about an eved, so an eved has to have awe and reverence for his master, and therefore he doesn't recline in the presence of his master. And the Gemara says that a married woman has to have this element of yira for her husband. Then the Gemara says, but if she's an Isha Chashuva, which again is an hour's discussion of what exactly is an Isha Chashuva, then she has to recline even in the presence of her husband.
When we say we're reenacting the actual night of Yetzias Mitzrayim, they didn't bring four kosas on the night of Yetzias Mitzrayim, did they?
No, when I say reenacting, what I meant to say is to show and demonstrate that you are rejoicing over your own personal redemption. And how do you rejoice? So at the time of the Chazal, when you recline and you drink wine, that's kederech hamalachim, like that's like the kings, not the slaves, the servants and the plebes, but like the upper class, so to speak. At the time of Chazal, when not only did they recline, but they drank wine. And wine, it was an experience of chayrus, of freedom. So all this is meant to both put us in the mood for Chayav Adam Liras Satzman, also to reflect outside that we are B'nai Chorin, that we're very free. Now, the whole year round, every single day of the year, we have a mitzvah to remember Mitzrayim. Zochar es Yom HaZeh Kol Yemei Chayecha. In fact, the Gemara, and we'll see it in the Haggadah itself, is going to claim that you have to remember Yetzias Mitzrayim both at night and by day, twice every 24-hour period. So what's so special about the night of the Seder? And the answer is twofold. Number one, that on this night, we have to study and we have to get to the point where we reach this frenzy, where we re-experience the liberation, the experience of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Number two, we have to recite Hallel. Hallel becomes an integral, essential part of the mitzvah of this night. Now, what's unique about the Hallel at the Seder night is that it's divided into two separate parts. The first part is injected into the second kos at the end of Magid, and the rest, the balance of Hallel, will be recited over the fourth cup, which is called Nirtzah. And we have to understand, why did Chazal organize it that challah should be split into two parts? They could be separated by hours, depending upon how long it takes you to eat the knedlah. But what I mean, that's if you eat shruya. The answer to this is that the two parts of halal relate to two different dimensions of geula. In other words, we express our praise to Hashem, our gratitude to Hashem, for two different types, fundamentally two different categories of redemption. One is the geula sha'avar, which means the redemption from Egypt. The second is the geula lahaba, for the coming redemption that should come speedily in our time. In fact, it seems from the Tanchuma that Mashiach is going to come on the 15th of Nisan. So when we go out to greet Eliyahu HaNavi, that's because Eliyahu is the harbinger of Mashiach. He's telling us already that Mashiach is on his way. And that's why we go out there and we say, Shvoch Hamascha L'Goyim Ashalo Yudu'ucha, because the first main job of Mashiach is to get rid of our adversaries. We have no compunctions, and there's no room for compassion here. And I say this with a lot of feeling, because I saw something, I couldn't believe it, but I don't even want to discuss it, because it just makes my blood pressure go up. And they call themselves Orthodox. Anyway, we'll leave that out for now. In any event, women are obligated as men to tell the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. If a woman doesn't understand, and for that matter, if a man doesn't understand what he's reading, it's worthless. Get a good translation in the vernacular. Sefer Yetzias Mitzrayim includes three elements. Number one, to retell all the story and all the miracles. Number two, to study. What do I mean to study? This is a classical and profound experience of Limud Torah. And that Limud Torah itself reflects itself in two ways. Number one, we take a parsha in the Torah. Does anybody know where in the Torah that is? Kitavo, correct. And we darshan that parsha, which means we read every section, every verse, and every part of every verse. And we not only read the Torah Shebichsav, the written Torah, but we also interpret, based on Torah Shebichsav, the oral Torah, each one of those phrases and each one of those verses. That's a complete mitzvah of Talmud Torah when you start with Torah Shebichsav and you end with Torah Shebal Peh. You may know that historically there was a breakoff from Orthodox Judaism, which was called the Tzdukim, and the Tzdukim, later the Karoim, they were the next branch that came from the Tzdukim. They denied Torah Shebal Peh. They were only interested in Torah Shebichsav. And somebody wrote a tshuva, a shaila, I should say, to Rav Nitroi Gaon, and he said, can I be yotzei the mitzvah of Yetzias Mitzrayim by just reading through all the parashiyos in Shmos, half of the book of Shmos, that tells the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim? And Rav Nitroi Gaon writes to me, not only aren't you yotzei, but I'm choshed that you belong to that kat, that group of karoim, of tzdukim, that deny Torah Shebal Peh. Because you just want to read the psukim in Torah Shebichsav. And the psukim that we read, which is called Arami Ovid Ovi, is a very concise, how do you say in English, a tamtzit, a... what's it called?
Preisi.
Summary.
Say it one more time.
Preisi.
I'm not familiar with that word. How do you spell that?
P-R-E-C-I-S.
P-R-E-C-I-S. A preisi of Yetzias Mitzrayim. And basically everything is in those psukim. By the way, the Mishnah says that we should be darshaning the entire parsha until the end of the parsha. That's not our minhag. Our minhag is only to read the first, I think it's five psukim in that parsha. There's another part of the parsha where we thank Hashem for bringing us to the land, and that's what the Mevi'a Bikurim, when they brought their first fruits to Jerusalem, they would recite the entire parsha, including entering into the land. But on the night of Pesach, we don't speak about entering into the land. We just have a prayer at the beginning of Pesach, of the Haggadah, and at the end of the Haggadah, to ask Hashem for the Geula, the ultimate redemption, L'shana Abba, B'Yerushalayim. The Mishnah itself was written at the time of the Beis HaMikdash, and at that time the existence of Eretz Yisrael as an independent state was a reality, and therefore included in the praise and the Shevach that we have to give to Hashem, we have to mention the end of the parasha. That's why the Mishnah says V'dorish, it's kol ha-parasha kula. Now I have here a sefer in front of me called HaSeder HaAruch, which is sort of an overview of the Seder. It's written by Weingarten. And I'm going to quote here what he says about Karpas, because this really caught my eye. Okay, then Shin Yutes Shin Chaf Aleph. And here's what I want to point out. Just give me a minute to get the page, if you don't mind. He says the following. Ochlim, we eat a yerek, a vegetable, tovel b'mashke, and we dip it into a liquid, kodem asa'uda, even before we start the meal. And why do we do so? Kidei lasos heker litinokos, that we make a change in what we normally would do. On a regular meal, we would not start the meal with a tibul of a yerek. Kidei she yishalu, so the children should ask the question, and why are we dipping a vegetable in the water? And he says the following. Number one, we don't have an answer to his question. There is no explanation as to why we dip a vegetable in water, in salt water. It's only to get him to ask the question. And then he writes that the second tibul is marar b'charoses. You remember that in the Manishtana, the child is going to ask why alayla zeh shtei pa'amim. We dip two times, two vegetables. The first vegetable we dip in water or salt water, and the second one we dip in charoses. And he says the following. He says, Hatibul Hasheni shall mar b'charoses hu ha'ikar, el she'im lo haya tovel, el es hamarar, lo haya nikar she'tovel she'im mitzvah. So he says that what makes the tibul in the second case, the second vegetable, which is mara, what makes it into a tibul l'shem mitzvah, it's not just l'shem heker, is the fact that we dip it into charoses. And by dipping it into charoses, we indicate clearly that this second tibul, that with the eating of the mara, has nothing to do with the se'uda per se, but rather with fulfilling the mitzvah of the chachamim. Now, in the footnote here, he says the reason why we eat karpas before the se'uda is so that we don't have to make two brachos over the maror. In other words, the al borei pri adam that we recite over the first tibul is going to cover us for the second tibul, which is maror. So we'll have one bracha on the first tibul, and that's borei pri adam, and the second bracha on the second tibul. In other words, what they wanted to do was indicate that one tibul is not part of the suda, and therefore requires its own bori pri adama, and as anything that's not bar machmas hasuda requires its own bracha, even though you made hamotzi. And then the second tibul,
we haven't made hamotzi yet.
Even if you haven't made hamotzi, but if it's the kickoff of the suda, so then why are you eating something outside of the framework of a suda, making a separate bracha on it? You should be incorporating it into the suda. In other words, on a normal night the rest of the year, they would not make a bar pri adam on a yerek because they would first wash and it would be included in bar machmas a suda. How do we demonstrate that this achila of the first tibul is not part of the suda? We make a bar pri adam. How do we demonstrate that the second tibul is not part of the suda? Is number one, by dipping it into charoses, but on a more profound level, by dipping it into charoses, we indicate that this is a tibul l'shem mitzvah. And eating the maror with, you know, after having dipped it into charoses, then we'll see that he has to shake off the charoses, but that itself makes it into a tibul l'shem mitzvah. Now, how many people here, if you could just give me a few more minutes, will use a potato for karpas and are willing to admit so? Okay. So he says the following. I just wanted to point this out to you. He says, Yesh la hakshos al minag zeh. He says, I'm not so excited about using a potato. Why? He says, Shetibul hakarpas hu kiderech b'nei chorin shetovlim yerek kodem achila. He says the following. that when you eat a raw vegetable, again, I don't know, you have to ask the dietitians, I'm not a scientist, I don't know. He says that by eating a raw vegetable before the Suda, it stimulates the appetite. But if you take a cooked vegetable, and a potato by definition has to be cooked, because otherwise you break your teeth, and maybe your stomach too, therefore, it doesn't have the effect of stimulating the appetite, but rather, on the contrary, it's masbia, it gives you a sense of satiation. So bottom line is that when you eat a potato, it doesn't stimulate your appetite, which is what we want to do because you're about to eat what? The matzah. The matzah. Because the matzah has to be eaten with a great deal of gusto. That's why we don't eat matzah on Erev Pesach. And not only that, we cut down our eating on Erev Pesach.
The matzah for another 2 hours.
So I don't know how many hours it takes you to get to the matzah, but I'm very proud that a member, an outstanding member of our community, says that I got it for 2 hours. I'm very excited about that. But be that as it may, I'm not giving you all the physics of it, but the bottom line is, and he's quoting again Rishonim here, so you should take a look at this. I have it here on page Shin Chof Aleph. They claim that, you know, you'll have even more gusto if you take a raw vegetable before the Suda and you eat it. My humble opinion is that if you're taking something raw and fulfilling his minug, again, if you, I'm not telling you to change your minug, then my best recommendation is to take a banana. Can we get bananas at this time of the year?
It's not a vegetable, though.
Of anything that has a bari pri adama is considered tibul. And the strangest thing is to take a banana. I tried it, it wasn't so bad. A banana in salt water. And I promise you, if there's a child at the table who's half intelligent, you know, maybe he's 4 years old or 3 years old, I don't even know how old, they will ask you, why are you eating a banana before the Suda dipped in salt water? And that's the goal here. To make a bari pri adama that'll link up to the Morar later and Patra up to Morar on something that stimulates the appetite and the curiosity of the children. Okay. Now, very important, people don't realize this. The entire Magid, that means the Sipri Tzitzayim, has to be recited over the matzah. The matzah must be exposed. And the reason for that is because matzah is called in the Torah Lechem Oni, which means not only the bread of affliction and the poor man's bread, it also means Sha'onim Olav Dvarim Harbe, that we recite a lot of things over the matzah. In fact, the earliest time for matzah is after nightfall. You cannot fulfill the mitzvah of matzah, even if you daven the early Mairiv and you mekabel on yourself Tosefes Yontiv, until nightfall. And there are many reasons for that, but one of them is because the mitzvah of Sipri Yetzis Mitzrayim is Bolaila, and the pasuk says Bavur Zeh, and Chazal say Bavur Zeh means, the Zeh means you point your finger to the matzah, and the matzah has to be right there, profoundly, you know, demonstrated on the Seder table. How many days do we have to eat matzah?
One.
Only one. Not even a whole day. Only on the night of Pesach. It says, Erev Tochlu Matzah. However, the Vilna Gaon has an amazing chiddush. And I found it in the Chizkuni. The Chizkuni was 7 centuries before the Gaon. He was one of the Rishonim of Chachmei Ashkenaz, that since the Torah says, Shivas Yomim, 7 days Tochlu Matzah, every time you eat matzah, you get a Kiyuma Mitzvah. Now, for those who are on diets, this is not a great news, because matzah is quite full of carbs, or if you're on a low-carb diet. But you should know that anytime you eat matzah, according to the Vilna Gaon, and as I said before, it's the Chizkuni way before the Gaon, during the 7 days of Pesach, you get a mitzvah. It doesn't mean that you're obligated to do so. The obligation is only on the first night, because it says, Ba'erev Toklu Matzahs. The Netzivni Valojin is of the opinion that although the barest requirement of eating matzah is 1 kezias, which is about 2/3 of a matzah, but nevertheless, if you add on the night of Pesach, anything you add expands your mitzvah.
That's 2/3 of a machine matzah, not one of these big
hand-built matzahs. A big matzah, I would say half a matzah should be enough. Now, there are those who say that you have to eat the entire kezias, the Belia Achas, with one swelling. So if you try that, You'll have to call the emergency service very quickly. But what you do have to do is eat the entire kezayis within what's called achilas pras. Achilas pras is generally assumed to be anywhere between 2 and 4 minutes. So if you want to be very machmir, make sure you get the kezayis down within 2 minutes. This is not the time to shmooze. A lot of people think, oh, we got to the matzah, now we're gonna talk this way and crack jokes and whatever have you. And there are plenty of jokes you can crack about the matzah, both in terms of the price that you paid for it and the card. I shouldn't call it cardboard, but the taste of the matzah. Hopefully this year we're going to have very good matzahs. They'll be fresh, they'll be whole, shlemos, not pieces, and we'll really enjoy the matzah. So with that, I want to wish everyone a great Chag Sameach, and thanks so much for joining me. We should be zochet lechol min hazvachin u'psachim, and if the Mashiach comes on the night of Pesach, as the Tanchuma says, it's going to happen. It's Leil Shimurim, and we should go out and greet Eliyahu HaNavi, and hopefully he has good news for us, because we could use some good news. Okay then? Thank you so much. Chag Sameach. If anyone wants to sell chametz, I'll be available tomorrow morning and hopefully next week. I'll be here tomorrow morning. We can sell chametz tomorrow morning. I'll be here for davening. If not, I'll be a half hour after davening, but pretty good.
Will the shiurim on the Epic website, or is there a different website?
It's a different website. It's called YU Torah. So if you send me, if you send me your email, I'll give you a link to that specific shiur. So you just have to press on it, and you can hear the shiur.
P-A-P-R-I-C-I-S.